Water?
Ah, yes, please.
Like some sparkling or still?
Whatever you're taking.
Yeah? It's quite nice, the sparkling water, actually.
Good afternoon, everybody. We are about to start the offering of thank you to Ajahn and the team who has been working hard on this project. And we are going to now play Metta Sutta in English. Those who want some help with a printed sheet, please put your hand up.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not to the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing England at his safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, all is ignorant, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state, Let none do anger or ill will, wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, why should sustain this recollection? This is to be the time of lighting, by not owing to false views, the pure-hearted one, having guided your vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Okay, so shall we just continue, I suppose? Is that right? Yeah? Okay, so then the studio.
Aha!
Okay, yeah. No, we okay.
What is happening?
Okay, gee, I say, Sadhu. You know it's not finished yet. You know that?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the keepest longer. I see. Okay. Okay. Gee. Okay. Wow. Wow. Full of cut. I can see.
Broken into your
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
Very good.
That is marvelous. So, yeah. I'll put this on the. You want this right? Okay. Yeah. Great. We'll go through it carefully later on. Yeah.
I think all the monks will enjoy these Calvin and Hobbes cartoons. I love this one.
But see who's not here now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for that. So, before the meditation, we looked at reasons why the Buddha encouraged to develop jhana, to be able to understand dependent origination, to be able to see the truth of the Dhamma, how life actually is. And we've seen that three reasons that Ajahn Brahm mentioned in his book, and which I think are also hinted at in the suttas as well, is three reasons is for jhana is, first of all, is you need some really strong mind, some really powerful mindfulness, some very clear awareness to be able to see things as they really are. Yeah? It's like almost the total opposite of being sleepy. It's like being super, super alert. That is what you need to be able to see these things that you haven't been able to see before. Second of all, it makes your mind really courageous, because the sense of self is very much weakened after you come out of jhana. And third point is that you need the jhanas for the data that they provide. You have this unique experience which gives you such a different view on life. So usually, I think, very often, if people have been coming to Buddhist sutta classes and talks by the nuns and the monks, and they've been listening to what the Buddha has said, and then if they would experience one of these deep jhana meditations, then I think very often the process after that will come very naturally, the process of reflecting on the jhana and to derive insight from your meditation will be very natural, because you have already heard some of its teachings. Yeah? In one of the suttas, the Buddha says, it is natural for somebody who has attained samadhi to get to know things as they really are. It's natural. You don't have to use willpower, he says. And so, why do I talk about how to use jhana? Yeah? I might as well say, oh, if you develop jhana, the rest, you don't need to use willpower. It will come naturally. But I think that in some cases, it may not come so naturally. And it may be helpful to have some little ways to use these jhanas to develop insight. So that's why I want to speak about that a little bit, and at least give you some ideas of how you can use these states of meditation to develop your wisdom. But first of all, I'd like to point out that in one of the suttas, the Buddha says, four things, when developed and cultivated, lead to the fruit of stream entry. So this is the insight that we talked about before. Associating with wise people. Hearing the true teaching, the true Dhamma. Wise focus and practice in accordance with the teaching. Wise focus is my translation for yoniso manasikara, sometimes wise attention. Yeah. So four things the Buddha says you need for to be able to enter the stream, to become a stream winner. And associating with wise people is hopefully what you do by coming to retreats and listening to wise Dhamma teachers and listening to the classes and the talks given here or by maybe on the internet. Yeah? So associating with wise people, you all do. So we can scrap that. We can say, that's what we do. We can strike that. Hearing the true teaching. This is the teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, hearing the suttas, hearing them explain the way things really are. Yeah, not hearing. If you don't hear the Buddha's teachings, then it is almost impossible for you to get the insights into those teachings, because that means you would have to be a Buddha yourself. Yeah? The Buddha was able to penetrate the Dhamma without anyone having to teach it to him. But for most people, you need to hear the teaching. But hopefully by doing all the sutta classes, etc., we will be able to hear the true teaching. Then there is the fourth one, is practice in accordance with the teaching. And I think this means practice the Eightfold Path. Yeah, practice your virtuous behavior and practice your meditation, ending in the jhanas. That's what I think is included in practice in accordance with the teaching. I think includes the jhanas, which we talked about before. And there is this thing, wise focus, which is what I want to talk about now. So wise focus means if you have some of these really powerful mind states, and to use that opportunity wisely, because your mind won't be powerful forever in that state. So when your mind is like that, it may be through a jhana, or maybe sometimes also before a jhana, you can have very powerful mind as well. If your mind is like that, use it wisely, use the wise focus to be able to do that. And don't be stupid about it. Don't go focusing on other things. Yeah. Don't be like I once was. I had a nice meditation, and after that was a sutta class, a Dhamma class in Bodhiyana Monastery. And Ajahn Brahm was teaching, and he started teaching, and I saw on the ceiling was a really beautiful light. So I looked at the light, oh, that's a really nice light. My mind was really strong, so the light really wow. I'd never seen a beautiful light like that before. Now, wow, I was like, wow. And then I heard Ajahn Brahm say the word porridge. And then I was, okay, porridge. And then I look at the light, wow. And it felt like I had only been looking at the light for 10 seconds. And then suddenly I heard all the monks say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And the talk was over. I had only heard the word porridge. So that for me, in my memory, goes under the name the porridge talk. Yeah, that's all I heard, porridge. And I heard that because I was the one who was making Ajahn Brahm's porridge at that time. So I think that's why I heard that and nothing else. So that is an example of unwise focus. Yeah, don't be like that. If you have a strong mind and you hear Dhamma, reflect on it. Use wise focus. That's why I think the Buddha pointed out wise focus is really important. Don't waste the opportunity when you have it. Yeah? So what do you focus on? Not on the lights on the ceiling, yeah? You focus on, especially on this data that you might get from deep meditation. Yeah? Focus on the Dhamma. Focus also on dependent origination. So I want to now talk a little bit about if you have a jhana experience, how you can use that to reflect on those 12 factors of dependent origination that we've seen before. And I'll go through it quite briefly, just to give you some ideas of how to reflect on these things. Because there are so many ways that you can reflect on the Dhamma. There is also suttas saying, there's somebody asks, oh, how did you get the insight? And he goes to various monks and asks, how did you get the insight into stream entry? And they all give a slightly different answer because they all reflected on different ways. One says, oh, I reflected on the five aggregates. Another one says, I reflected on the six senses. Another one said, I reflected on what arises, passes away. So they all reflect slightly differently. And there are so many ways to reflect on these kind of things that I can only point out a few things. And so let's see how that goes. So let's take the first factor of ignorance or delusion. One big factor of delusion is the sense of self. And in the jhanas, the sense of self is temporarily gone completely. Yeah. Buddha says, I am is a way of identifying. I am this, I will be, I won't be, I will have form, I won't have form, I will be aware, I won't be aware, I will be neither aware nor not aware. There are all ways of identifying. This is Ajahn Sujata's translation, often translated as conceit, I think. You should train your mind to be free from identification. And in jhana, your mind is free from identification. You might not realize this if you don't really reflect on it very properly, but the way into the jhanas was by letting go of you, whoever you were. This is when you could really start to understand what anatta means, because the jhanas happen regardless of you. It's doesn't seem to make any sense at all when I just explain it like that. Or when you might experience this, then reflect on this sense of self that is gone. Yeah. The jhanas are completely empty inside. They're like an empty space. There is no you there. There is nothing in there. And that is why you will never hear us give meditation instructions like this. Find your center. And then there is a really sad donut sitting here, yeah? Because it can't find the center. But that's really Buddhist, right? To not be able to find your center, you know, like the sense of self, or the self. Ajahn Brahm sometimes calls himself Ajahn Donut. Round at the outside, empty on the inside. So that is a way that you can reflect on delusion. In jhana, temporarily you don't have a sense of self. So that gives you an idea of what the mind of an arahat would be like. Yeah? Your mind in jhana would be exactly the same as the mind of an arahat in jhana. Because temporarily your mind is just like that. And the next factor, willed acts. In this deep meditation, the will is very much decreased. And when in ordinary life, we have a will or a volition for all kinds of things. We want to do this, we want to go there, and our intentions drive us every which way. But in jhana, there is only a slight little bit, in the first jhana, I should say, there's only a slight little bit of will left. And you can see how this will is totally out of control, because it is sort of, Ajahn Brahm calls this the wobble of the mind. And it is the mind, your will sort of tries to go deeper into the peace, but it realizes by trying, it sort of ruins it. So therefore, it goes back again. It sort of, it sees that by trying to grab onto the peace, it destroys it, because it's like doing something again, and that doing destroys the peace. So then it lets go again, and the peace increases again. Then the mind tries to grab onto it again. It's the Ajahn Brahm calls this the wobble. The mind sort of goes like this, holding on, letting go, holding on, letting go. But this is all involuntary, really. This is you, because there's no sense of self. The mind just does this by itself. And you will also realize that if this will would disappear, because it's all conditioned, then you see that this will is the thing that sort of drives us in samsara. Yeah? It's this trying to grab on. We've talked about before about taking up things. Yeah? This will, you can see in the jhana a little bit how it tries to take things. But you will realize if the will would disappear forever, then there would not be no more force for a rebirth. And it reminds me of the little story of a little novice monk. And the little novice monk, he was always cleaning the abbot's hut. And in the abbot's hut, there was a letter. And the letter looked like this. It says will on it. But it was actually in an envelope. And there. And it says on there, will, only to be opened after my death. You know, this is what the abbot wrote on the envelope. And the novice always, when he was cleaning the abbot's hut, he always found this envelope, and he just wanted to know, what is the will of my abbot teacher? What does he want after he passes on? And he always wanted to open it, but of course he couldn't. He had to wait. And one day, his teacher died, the abbot died. And the novice monk was able to look inside of the envelope. What was the will? What was the desire of his beloved teacher? And of course, the envelope was totally empty. Yeah. His teacher had no will at that. Had nothing to desire. He left no will behind. And this is like an arahant. They have no will. Because they have no will when they die. Therefore they and get reborn. Yeah. So two ways you kind of reflect on the will in the first jhana is it's totally out of your control. That is how you can reflect on anatta. You can also reflect on it as creating rebirth. And if there would be no will, then forever, then there would be no rebirth also. And the next factor, moving on. I've combined two here, so this is the third and fourth factor of dependent origination. Consciousness and the other aspects of a being. When you have one of these really deep experiences, I just limit this explanation to the first jhana, but it could be second, third, fourth, or even deeper jhanas, then you, as I said before, you have this very special kind of experience, and you see the mind from the inside out. And this is what gives you a lot of information about how rebirth could happen, because you see inside of yourself something that is sort of beyond the body, and you see it gives you so much faith in rebirth, because you see this like, I have to be careful with my words here, because I can't say like it's not like an entity that you see, but it's like you see this energy, this like the mind, the process of the mental process, you see it really, really clearly in a way you've never seen it before. And this gives you a lot of faith and trust that there must be such a thing as rebirth, because you realize that this thing you see, it won't just die when the body dies, because it's something totally separate from it. Yeah. So you, by having the jhanas, you can see how the process of rebirth can continue. That is sort of what these two factors sort of imply. As I said, I'm sort of being a bit brief here, but these consciousness and the other aspects, they imply the process of rebirth. Yeah, you see, in jhana, you see really clear only mental consciousness, but you realize how this can perpetuate into a future life. So, sort of look an illustration. I don't know if it makes any sense, but you could see like this sort of a thread that sort of links together different lives. This is like the mind in a way, in the visual image. It's a bit, doesn't look like that, of course, in reality, but yeah. Hope I'm making some sense here, but as I said before, it will only make sense if you have these experiences, but I trust you all have this ability to attain these deep meditations one day, and maybe that will be very soon, or maybe it will be very far in the future. It doesn't matter. But I'm just giving you these ideas now on how you can use your mind then, if you have a deep meditation, yeah? How you can use the wise focus. Moving on again to the six senses. The Buddha speaking, if somebody says the sense of sight has an essence, an atta, that is unjustifiable, the arising and vanishing of sight is seen, which then will mean that one's essence arises and vanishes. Therefore, it is unjustifiable to say that the sense of sight has an essence. So the sense of sight has no essence, has no soul, no atta, no self, is often translated as self. And then it's similar for hearing, smell, taste, and touch. So in jhana, as I said, the five senses have disappeared, and you only experience the sixth sense, only the mind. It's pure mental experience. Yeah? And this makes you realize that those five senses, as it says here, they're vanishing. They're seen. You've seen them temporarily just go away. You didn't experience it at all, those five senses. You only experienced the mind. And this gives you a lot of insight into those five senses, that they have to be temporary. They can't have an essence. They can't have a self in them, because you've seen them just disappear for a while. Yeah. By the way, there are some meditation experiences where the five senses can already disappear, but it doesn't really qualify as jhana. Like really deep nimittas, for example, can also already be without the five senses. But I'm saying this because I realize that there may be quite a few people in the world who think they have attained some jhana, but it's not real, not really the jhana as I understand it. And be careful with that, because if you think you've attained the jhana and you start contemplating things, then you may do it wrongly. You may not have the right data yet. Yeah? So always try to not overestimate your experiences in meditation. And the Buddha continues the sutta, if somebody says the mind has an essence, that is unjustifiable too, because arising and vanishing of the mind is seen, which means one essence arises and vanishes. Therefore, it's unjustifiable to say the mind has an essence. So the mind has no essence. So in jhana, the five senses disappear, so you know those can't be an essence. They are impermanent. But for stream entry, you also have to let go of the mind as well. Then it disappears as well. And you see it vanish, then you know, okay, there's no essence in that as well. Yeah? And you will also realize there's nothing beyond that as well. It's not like a seventh sense or whatever. Yeah? It's just the five senses and the mind. Moving on again. Sense impressions. I'm going a bit quickly because I thought I would have a bit more time for this, but I just was just too slow before the break, so just moving it on a bit. Sense impressions. Remember the sense impressions? I give this simile of the cards, yeah? And the idea of sense impressions was that you always need an object for consciousness to happen. As it says here at the bottom, without a condition, meaning without an object, consciousness cannot arise. You cannot be conscious of nothing. You always have to be conscious of something. And the sense of sight, you can't have a sight consciousness without actually seeing without seeing an object. And it's the same with the mind. This is where people sometimes get confused. Because the mind also needs an object always. The mind, as in meaning the ability to know something, some mental object. So this mind consciousness also always needs a condition. And you understand that when a sense impression ceases, the associated sensation will also cease. And I talked about this a little bit before, that usually in our everyday experiences, our life is so hectic. We always experience all the six senses all the time, and they alternate all the time, and we experience so much so quickly that we can't really contemplate things properly. This process of passa, sense impressions, also translated as contact. You can't really contemplate it because things happen so quickly. But after a deep meditation, where there's the mind only, then you can contemplate on this much better. You can ask yourself what will happen when the object of consciousness in the jhana would cease. What would happen if that would cease? And you might realize that the consciousness depends on the object. If you would take the thing you know away, then the knowing itself would also go away. Yeah. Maybe ask yourself that one day. It's pretty cool stuff. The next factor, sensations. And after this, I'll speed it up a bit and do a lot at once, but sensations. Is this Sariputta, I think, speaking? And it may be the Buddha, so I can't remember now. I think it's... Yeah, this is the Buddha. The next sutta is Sariputta, I think. So here the Buddha is saying, if you consider extinguishment, nibbana, the cessation of the six senses, if you consider it to be unpleasant, dukkha, then you cannot have a perspective in line with my teaching. Without such a perspective, you cannot enter the right path, and you cannot attain the fruit of stream entry. Yes, talking about how do we get this fruit of stream entry. But if you consider extinguishment to be pleasant, to be sukha, you can have a perspective in line with my teaching. With such a perspective, you can enter the right path, and you can attain the fruit of stream entry. Here it uses dukkha and sukha not so much in the context of sensations, but this is the next sutta where I think that comes up. Venerable, extinguishment and nibbana is pleasant, Sariputta says. But then Venerable Daya asked him, but Venerable, what can be pleasant when nothing is experienced? Then exactly that is pleasant, that nothing is experienced. Yeah. This sounds a bit weird, huh? But why is it pleasant when nothing is experienced, when all the six senses cease? And then Sariputta explains it by pointing us back to the four jhanas and also the four immaterial states as well. But I'll just stick to the first jhana for this explanation. So here we have Sariputta saying, here the dot, 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 he sort of explains, and how can you come to understand this, that it is pleasant, that not when nothing is experienced? He says, after you withdraw from the physical senses, from the five senses, and unskillful states, and you enter the first jhana, where there is rupture and pleasure caused by that withdrawal, to which the mind moves and holds on. This is that will that I talked about before, the mind moving and holding on. If in that state, or going out of that state, would be maybe a bit more accurate, you begin to perceive or shift back to the senses, to the karma, that will be an affliction to you, that will be painful in a sense to you. Because you're inside. Imagine going inside of your house, and you shut all the doors, and it's really nice and peaceful inside. Yeah. But outside it may be very, very noisy. You open all the doors again, and all the noise comes back in. It's just the same when you go into jhana. It's really nice and peaceful inside. But when the senses come back, that's when the jhana ends at that moment, then you realize that is pain, that is suffering compared to just being nice and peaceful inside. That will be an affliction to you, those five senses. And then Sariputta says, just as pain that might come up is mere affliction to one who feels at ease. Like you feel really comfortable and then you get stung by a bee. I had that the other day. I was just thinking, oh, I'm nice and peaceful, and a bee right in my lip. And there went my peace, to be honest. But also my feeling of comfort, yeah, because it hurt quite a bit when a bee stabs things in your lip, I can tell you that. So pain that comes up is mere affliction, is suffering to one who feels at ease. Likewise, if in that state, in that jhana, or going out of that jhana, you begin to perceive or shift back to the senses, that will be affliction to you. Just like you feel nice and peaceful, and then suddenly you feel pain, like a bee sting. You realize that it's painful, that bee sting. Similarly, if you're in the jhana, but the senses come back, you realize that it is actually painful, those five senses. It's much more nicer to be without them. So, continues the sutta, that is one way you can come to understand that extinguishment is pleasant. Because you realize, the cessation of the five senses, although it's only temporary, is really pleasant. It's really, really nice. It's really like, as I said, like closing all your doors and windows and being nice and peaceful inside. It's like that, sort of. It's really nice and pleasant. You will realize that. And then you can extrapolate. Okay, if being without five senses is so peaceful, how about being, quote unquote, without any senses at all? What if all the senses would cease? The sixth sense would also cease. Yeah. That's how the sutta continues. And then the mind starts ceasing as well in the higher jhanas and the so-called arupa states. You can become to understand how nibbana is pleasant by reflecting like that. I really like this sutta because just this direct link between how to use the jhanas to reflect on nibbana and how to get insight out of that. Because of course, understand that extinguishment is pleasant, that is sort of is like a synonym in a sense for stream winning. That's when you really understand that. So a lot of factors of Dhamma come together in this sutta. It's one of my favorites. Oh, it's very nice. So you can read it in full. It's in the Anguttara Nines. It's really quite nice. So the reason I put this on the sensations is because in the jhana, so many sensations have ceased, all these sensations of the five senses. You can reflect on that and realize that they are quite suffering, actually. One more, and then maybe we take a little breaky. I'll just put the rest together to say some time. So craving, fuel, life, birth, old age and death. Yeah. You see, in the jhana there is no craving. And you sort of come back to this thing of will. Well, there is a little bit of will in jhana, but it doesn't really count as craving, I would say. But in the first jhana there is. And you see how there is, if there is no craving, and there would forever be no craving, you will realize that that the process of rebirth will have to stop, because the craving is what fuels a next life. The next life, meaning birth, then you have all this old days and death and suffering. You realize that through the process of cessation, which the jhanas really are, is a process of cessation. Through the process of cessation, you can get out of this eternal loop. So when you understand that, we've seen this before, as a noble disciple whose mind has attained samadhi, who has attained the jhana, you can understand this, that samsara has no discoverable beginning. And you see how I won't go into that. You can find no start to the transmigration to samsara, to beings roaming around and being bound by ignorance and tied by craving. You realize that this craving is really what ties you to samsara. Because in the jhana you don't have this craving. You can compare the mind without craving to a mind with craving. And you can only understand really what craving is by letting it go for a while. And before jhana, it will be very rare for you to be without craving, I would say. If you are without craving at all, you don't have the mindfulness to notice. Yeah, so in jhana you can really see a mind clearly without craving. And from that you can begin to contemplate how the craving would be the thing that fuels rebirth. So those were just some very brief ideas. And it's a very big topic and one that I really like, but to be a bit brief on it, but just to give you some ideas on how to use these meditation experiences. So this is really where your meditation and these pieces of dependent origination really come together, I would say. Yeah. This is where the whole Dhamma begins to blossom, when you combine these really deep meditations with these teachings by the Buddha, put them together, it's like explosions can go off, like boom! Really your mind is sort of almost literally exploding at the time when you see it. And I said before that I had 4 points. Why care? What do you see? And do you need jhana and how to use jhana? And I've addressed those now. But I wanted to add a fifth point. And this is namely that you can do it. Yeah. All these ideas, as I said before, they may sound really deep, they may sound unrelatable. They're like, what the hell are you on about, Sunyo? I don't get this at all. Yeah? It's maybe that you think like that. And I would understand that, and I would say, don't worry. You can do it. You can, let go. You can undo. If you stop doing, that's when these things happen. This is when the jhanas happen and all the insights happen, when you stop doing. When you let go. But you can do the letting go. I'm convinced that you all have this in you. And the Buddha said this as well. He said, few people cross over to the other shore. This means going over from samsara, which is illustrated here by a big ball of people on fire. You know? Only a few go over to the other shore of nirvana. You see here, a few mendicants. To use the new translation, a few mendicants going into what is sort of illustration of nirvana. Nirvana doesn't look like that, of course, but it's just illustration. So only a few cross over. Most only run up and down this bank. Most only run up and down this side of reality, really. They always stay in samsara, is what that means. They don't cross over out of samsara. But if after hearing the well-taught Dhamma, you practice according to it, then you'll go across beyond the reach of death, so difficult to overcome. So if you hear the Dhamma and you practice accordingly, then it's unavoidable that one day you'll go across. beyond the reach of death, beyond the reach of Mara. And that means you'll get out of samsara. Yay, yippee, yoy. And then you all, these workshops will have much, much fruit if somebody of you will be able to do that. But I think you'll all be able to do this because the Buddha says it. Just if you hear the Dhamma, which you do, and you practice accordingly, it's unavoidable. These things will happen because it's law of nature. Yeah, it's not up to you. It's, the Dhamma will take care of itself. It will get you out of here. The process will end. So that's where I wanted to leave you for now. And maybe you can do a little meditation again, do some questions, and then after that we'll sum up everything we've been talking about in these last 6 weeks. Ding. Sorry, I couldn't reach the bell. So, by the way, if it says here few people cross over, it doesn't mean few people who attend the dependent origination classes will cross over. It's not what it means. It means just few people in general, like few people in the world. Yeah. There's already few Buddhists, there's even fewer Buddhists who meditate. There's very few Buddhists who meditate and practice Dhamma very sincerely and come to classes like this. So it means few people. That's how I interpret it anyway. So don't, if you see few people will cross over, don't exclude yourself, yeah? Don't think, oh, the few people, there must be somebody else than me. No. You are those few people. What I think. Anyway, if there's any questions, please find a microphone. And also, Jake, if you have the questions from online, you can answer those as well.
Ajahn, when you summarize the proceedings, could you also please touch on the transcendental way of looking at the 12 links, please, because that is another way of looking at it in a brighter manner, I suppose.
You mean the cessation?
Cessation,
yeah,
yes, please. Yeah, just
in the plans
it.
Already.
Okay,
yes,
thank
right.
you.
Yeah, it's
no, you should say you do this especially for him. And unplanned.
Yeah, we'll do it especially for you and this in the plan.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, then they don't say sorry.
The yoniso manasikara, which is the wise focus. So you come to the Dio talk like we have, and you're sitting there meditating, and you have some experience. Is it always a reflection after? Obviously, you can't do it during, because you don't want to spoil whatever the experience is. So is it always after the fact that you reflect about your experience and then give it some meaning?
Yeah. So the question is, do we always reflect after your meditation? I would encourage that to do it like that. Yeah. When you meditate, try to find peace and happiness, and then after your meditation, reflect on it. But this reflection itself can also be a form of meditation. Yeah? So it just depends on how you define meditation. In a sense, the contemplation is also a sort of meditation. But when it comes to the jhanas that I've talked before about, then the mind is so still, it can't contemplate at that time. It's impossible, because it's just too quiet, too subtle to be able to contemplate. So in that case, you really have to come out of the jhanas to be able to contemplate them. Yeah. It's impossible to do it inside of it. But all the meditation that precedes the jhanas, you can still think and you can still reflect. And it is often helpful to use a bit of that to find your way to more peace. Reflect on why am I not peaceful right now, for example. Ask yourself that question. And then you'll get some insight into how to proceed in your meditation to find more peace.
So does that mean you have to read a lot of the teachings to understand and develop? So it's like a...
Yeah.
Like you might have this samadhi, but how does the path then continue if you don't? Do you need to read and have wisdom and virtue for all of it to feel?
I would say most people probably overestimate how much they would need to read. That's what I would say. If you, these insights, they are on a level of feeling, not on a level of intellect. So we've seen in the suttas that sometimes people, they only hear a very little Dhamma and they get the insights from that. And I would assume that they had these samadhi experiences before. And that is why they only need so little Dhamma, because the real data, as I said before, the data comes from the jhanas really. And then the suttas are sort of, they're not so much the data that you use. So you don't need to study much or learn much, I think. We probably already explained way more than you need. I hope so, anyway.
Ajahn. I believe Ajahn Chah used to say that Samatha and Vipassana are two sides of the same coin. You need both to attain enlightenment. Now, the Rupa Jhanas, if you are skillful in them, will take you to the Deva realms, and the Arupa Jhanas will take you to the Brahma realms. Now, there is still the I Am there. So just now the slide that you show, where the I Am, seems to indicate that all the different senses, jhanas, takes you to different realms, but that is still the I Am there. So basically, I suppose we need to even let go of all these jhanas before we can gain enlightenment. Could you please verify that? Thank you.
Yeah, you need to let go to the attachment of the jhana. And also, when you come out of jhana, if you use unwise focus, you may think, I was in the jhana and I exist there and the mind will exist forever, for example. That would be unwise focusing. But if you really focus properly, then you see that there was no self in the jhana at all. You can't think I am in the jhana. And those kind of ideas are gone then. That doesn't mean that you're enlightened yet. Yeah? So although you go into a jhana and the sense of self is gone, it's only temporarily. So you may come out again and then start identifying with things again, even with the jhana experience itself. And that kind of identifying can be, I think, one of the reasons why there may be rebirth in those kind of jhana realms. You know, still attachment to it, still some sort of idea that they own it or that they have this experience. But if you really dissociate from the experience, if you really see it as anatta, as non-self, then you can't really be born there again either in those kinds of realms.
If you bring back the slide, it seems to indicate that perception and non-perception is probably the highest of the jhanas, and it is the I Am is still there. If you could bring up the slide.
I'll bring up the slide again here. Can find it. Is this the one? Yeah. But this is not talking about the jhanas per se. This is just talking in general. So when it says I am is a way of identifying, doesn't mean in the jhanas. It's just in general when you think I am in general or I exist. Yeah, and you can only do that outside of the jhanas. Then, if you have that kind of idea, really, that I am kind of conceit they call it, then that is a way of identifying, which is not in line with the Dhamma. Hope that answers your question.
Basically, we should talk about this. These are all jhana states.
No, this is not talking about the jhanas. This is just in general how you should train your mind to be free from identification, both in the jhana and outside of them as well.
Can I just add a little bit? The idea is that the underlying tendency is still there. It's called the asmimana anusaya. The underlying tendency to the thought I am is still there. It's almost like, you know, when you go to sleep at night, you don't really think I am at that point. You have no sense of identity. But it's only a matter of time before it will reassert itself again. So it's like there, but it's temporarily let go of. That is what happening in the jhana states. It's gone temporarily because you cannot really have any mental movement in the jhana state. As soon as you come out, it will tend to come back again fairly quickly. Sometimes taking the jhana state itself as the object of the I am. But I think the point that Venerable Sunya was making, which I think is a very important one, is that a lot of the I am has already disappeared. When you go into a jhana, you will see that the entire sensory realm, for example, is outside of the I am. The I am has been cornered into a very, very narrow area. Yeah, only the jhana itself is really becomes the object of that I am. So you have let go of a large part of the I am has completely been let go of, and only a tiny thing is left. And so there's less insight to be done. Yeah, there's only a tiny area left for the insight. And this is part of the data that you have collected by entering the jhana. You have narrowed down the scope for the I am experience, or the I am thought or conception.
But inside the jhana is not there at all, but outside of it, you may only have a little bit left. Yeah. I hope that answers your question.
When you were explaining the sense impressions, you said that it's the attention that directs which sense impression we experience. What directs our attention?
I would say the will, to some extent, directs the attention. Because that is going out to different things. Going here and now there.
Is it because of previous karma that our attention is drawn here or there through the will? Or so what I'm saying is, if there's nothing, in the end there's nothing within. And for consciousness to arise, there needs to be a sense impression, right? If we go backwards, what directs that I'm going to be looking at this or at that, and I'm going to be listening to this or to that?
Yeah, maybe there's no. What is the thing that directs it? Maybe it's the wrong question. If a loud bang would go off outside, right now, then we would all hear it, and we don't choose to not hear it. You can't choose to not hear it. It's unavoidable that you will hear it. So it's just an automatic process sometimes, what we pay attention to, and it's not really so much that there is that we decide upon it, or that there is something underneath. It's just the mind basically picks it up because it's so prominent, that bang would be so prominent. That the mind would, first the ear goes after it basically, almost physically, in a physical level, it's triggers it first, and then the mind would notice it. It's just, so I would say the mind is what decides what you notice.
So it's the strongest, let's say, sense impression, the most gross, usually draws our attention.
Yeah, not always. For sometimes when you focus on the more subtle things, for example, in these deep meditations, you can't hear any sounds at all. Even there may be a bang outside. You even see in the suttas, there's a thunderstorm, but they don't hear it, and the monks don't hear it because they're so deep inside, and because the mind is focused inside. So I would say the mind is what picks it out, and whether we call that attention or whatever, these are just all labels for different processes that the mind does. Yeah, so attention, I wouldn't say, is not so much a thing as such.
Yeah, I mean, so one thing is the fact that there is an external impulse which is very powerful. I think that's actually, there's a simile for that in the suttas. You have the six animals. Yeah, the six. I don't know if you remember that sutta. They're all tied together. And then whatever animals is the strongest, they're the one that kind of leads you off. And that would be an example of a strong external sensory input, which then kind of grabs your attention. But there's many other factors, like your habits, what you normally do, what you normally are interested in. For example, in human beings, the sense of sight is very dominant. It takes about 80% of our attention or something. So the sense of sight will tend to kind of drive this process. But much more interesting, I think, than how this happens is not so much which sense arises, but how we deal with those senses. Yeah, and there's two ways that attention happens. Either attention is yoniso or it is ayoniso. Either it is wise attention or it is unwise attention. So rather than thinking about which sense it is, much more interesting to think about whether the attention is wise or unwise. careful or uncareful. That is really what matters. Because if the attention is wise, then you will tend to grow in wholesome qualities and decline in the bad ones. So that is where the focus should be, I would say, whether it is wise or unwise. And then you will be heading in the right direction.
How do you direct it to be the wise?
You come to the dependent origination course. Yeah, this is how you do that. This is about conditioning. Yeah, this is entirely about conditioning. So you have to learn. You have to agree. Yeah, the Buddha has a point. Yeah, there's, why am I getting upset in this situation? There's no point in getting upset because people are just people, and there's nothing I can do about it. Why do I have greed for all these silly things in the world when really I can just be content with what I have? Yeah, these kind of conditioning will then make you have yoniso manasikara, wise attention, with your sensory input.
I see there is more question here and online, but I think we'll take them afterwards. Sorry, but I'll answer your question afterwards. Is that okay?
It follows on from what he was asking.
Okay, if it follows nicely, then yeah.
Where consciousness, you said, arises due to a sense impression. Without a sense impression, there's no consciousness arising. But there's always mental impressions. So that's why the consciousness doesn't cease, because of the constant mental impressions that keep. Is that correct? Am I understanding this? Because consciousness then would only cease in Nibbana and not before, because there's always mental impressions. Even in jhana, the rapture, the whatever, is a mental impression that keeps the consciousness holding on to it. So that it's only in Nibbana then that consciousness ceases. Is
not necessarily. It can also happen temporarily before Nibbana. That the mind the mind consciousness ceases for a little bit as well. Can happen before.
Is that in the jhanas or?
One thing is like what they call the cessation of feeling and perception, which also includes consciousness. Yeah, that's one way it can happen. So that's what sometimes called the ninth dhyana, although that isn't used in the suttas.
And It's only in that state and Nibbana that the consciousness ceases. Otherwise, the mental object keeps it going. Is that right?
Well, it depends on how you define it, I suppose. I think it can also happen in other ways as well. Like when you let go of the mental sense so strongly, and then it will give rise to stream entry, that's also when it ceases for a while. And I wouldn't call that the cessation of feeling and perception, because it doesn't arise from the jhanas.
But that's an experience of Nibbana. Yeah. It's an experience of Nibbana.
Yeah, you could call it that. Yeah. That depends a bit on words, sort of.
But isn't stream entry just an initial experience of Nibbana?
And that. But it's not true Nibbana yet, because Nibbana only applies to arahants. But it's sort of, there's a simile in the suttas. The stream enter can see the water in the well, but they can't drink it. The water deep down in the well, they don't have a bucket to get it up. So they have seen Nibbana, but they can't drink it yet, right? So they are not arahants yet, but they know Nibbana, they've seen it. But they don't have it yet. So.
I've got another question about this stream meaning. So, if a stream meter has 7 more lives, what happens in rebirth for a stream meter?
Sorry?
Is there anything in the suttas where the Buddha explains what happens in rebirth of a stream meter? I mean, obviously there's a difference.
Yeah, they can only be reborn in a human realm or higher realms. They cannot be reborn as animals or hungry ghosts or whatever. Only up from here, basically, in rebirth. So.
And there must be a different mental something different. For
them. They still have attachments and desires and craving is all still there. It's much weaker, though, generally. And their sense of self, especially, is what is less weak. Yeah. So that's why their rebirths are different.
Is there a sutta that the Buddha gave about rebirth of, once you attained.
Not the specific process, but it's very often said that they only can be reborn in higher realms, no more lower realms, no more hell realms. That sort of stuff is that's mentioned all the time.
There is a sutta about the different kinds of stream entrants. Yeah, different kinds. One is the one that has seven lives, and the other one is called the Kolankola stream entry, which gets reborn in the human realm twice or two or three times. The Ekabidja stream entry, which is the one who has only one rebirth in the sensory realm. So stream entries is a variety of people, yeah, depending on the strength of your faculties and all these kind of things. And then there's the Jhananagami. You know, heard about the Jhananagami? Really? Wow, you're missing out. So the Jhananagami is the one that, you know, any Aryan, including stream entries, who enter Jhana when they die, yeah, it can happen when you die because you are skilled in meditation, you enter the Jhana, and then when you come out of the Jhana, you get reborn in the Jhana realm, and then when that realm ends, bang, Nibbana. The Jhananagami. Yeah. That's the fast way if you are a stream entry.
Fast track.
Now you're talking difficult. I think it's in the Anguttara 4s, around maybe around 123 or something like that in the Anguttara 4s. Search for Jhananagami here. Yeah? And then you find it there somewhere.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think that's the commentaries call it that. Yeah, they describe this process. Yeah.
I see, but the word is actually used in the suttas, well. Only once in the suttas,
oh,
I think.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I stand corrected. Alrighty. Because then you would look for it, otherwise you couldn't find it. But if it's in there, you will. All right, try to answer the questions a little bit briefly, but you know how these things go by now. We never learn, me and Ajahn Bhavani, to keep things short, anyway.
Okay. My turn?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I will speak. So, now we are going to sum up. Yeah, coming to the very end. And I'm going to briefly go through dependent origination in forward or in arising mode and also in cessation mode. So these are the two ways that dependent origination is described in the sutta. As the arising mode is when you start with avidya, with ignorance at the beginning, and the result is dukkha. Oh, no, it's a rising mode. A rising mode is a kind of the sad mode, yeah? And then they have the happy mode of dependent origination, which is the ending sequence. When you end avidya, you end dukkha. And when you end dukkha, you are happy as a consequence, yeah? That's kind of the point. This is why Nibbana is said to be the highest bliss in the suttas. Yeah? So let's have a look, go through the arising mode one more time, yeah? So to remind everyone what we have been doing to bring everything together, because some people said there's been so much information, so much scattered things, it's nice to kind of bring all of these things together again. So there is the arising mode, the 12 factors, 11 links between the 12 factors, and start off with ignorance, known as avidya in Pali. And ignorance is can be defined in a number of ways. Before we define it, important to remember that what supports ignorance, according to the suttas, is the five hindrances. And this is very useful information, because so much of the path of practice and what we're trying to do is about reducing the hindrances. Yeah? We always talk about the hindrances. So once you overcome those hindrances, once you reduce those, actually you are dealing directly with ignorance at the very beginning of the path, the very beginning of dependent origination. It's a very useful thing to remember, yeah? So you are kind of getting to the very core of what Buddhism is about by eliminating these hindrances. And if you have more hindrances, it's the opposite. You are strengthening the whole of dependent origination. So what is this ignorance? What is this delusion or illusion at the beginning here? And one way that I like to think about it, it is not understanding the three characteristics of Buddhism, yeah, of suffering, impermanence, and non-self. This is what it is about. If we don't understand these fundamental things, it means that we think that happiness is to be found where it is not to be found. We're actually looking for happiness, but we find dukkha, we find suffering instead. This is one of the core delusions of Buddhism. Yeah? So because We think that we know where happiness is, but actually it is suffering. What we do is we go looking for happiness in the wrong place. And that is the willed actions, which is the second part of this. Yeah, the willed actions coming in is actually the looking for happiness in the wrong place. So this is the first problem. Yeah, the second problem with ignorance is that is the idea that we take what is non-self to be a self. And because it feels like we are somebody, that we have a sense of self, it makes us feel that we are the agents in our own life. We are the creators. We are the makers. Yeah, we feel like we have that power inside of us. This is me. I'm the doer. And because it feels that we have the power to create happiness, and because we know where that, we think we know where that happiness is to be found, again, it tends to lead to actions. Yeah, we go out into the world. We think the happiness is to be found in relationships, in the sensory things in the world, in acquisition of things, in status, in all of these kind of things. And if you are really smart and you kind of go a long way on the spiritual path, you think final happiness is to be found in the jhanas, yeah? That is kind of union with God or something like that, if you come from another religious tradition. And all of this leads to a certain way of acting, yeah? And when we act in this way because of this misunderstanding of reality, what we are doing at that point is that we are making karma through those actions. Yeah, sometimes because we want to fulfill these aspirations of ours, if something gets in the way of creating that happiness, we can make bad karma because, you know, someone is getting in the way of that important relationship we want to have. We do something bad so we can have that happiness in our life. Or if the pursuit of that happiness is done in the good way, yeah, with kindness in the positive way, then of course we make good karma in the pursuit of that happiness. And in this way, we build up good or bad karma in our life, yeah, through these willed actions, depending on the circumstance, whether we do good things or bad things. So we get this balance sheet, yeah, of good and bad karma. Of course, the more spiritual you become on this path, the more you lean towards good karma and you lean away from the bad karma. So you do more good actions. The less kind of spiritual inclination you have, the more worldly you are, the more you tend to do bad karma, because that is where you see happiness. So it is worthwhile pursuing it with whatever means you have. Yeah. So you're building up your karmic balance, and at the same time you are looking towards the future for happiness. So there's craving there, always craving coming with this kind of happiness. So as you are building up this balance thing, then your consciousness, yeah, will tend to be established at a certain level, yeah, and that level can often be experienced inside of you. If you are clear about how to experience your consciousness, where it inclines, you can see that inclination of the consciousness, yeah, coming through those willed activities. Your consciousness is stationed at a certain level. And because it is stationed at a certain level, then when you die, it continues at that level. Yeah? And it, just because you are a human being doesn't mean that your consciousness is stationed as a human being. That will depend on all of these inclinations, all of these willed actions that you are doing. Yeah? You can raise your consciousness or you can lower it down, depending on how you live your life. Then you get reborn at that station. Because you get reborn at a certain station, the other khandhas, the other aspects of your personality and the body, they will be decided by that rebirth. If you get reborn in the human realm, then your khandhas, your experience of the world will have certain limitations to it. Yeah, you can be happy to some extent, you can be sad to some extent, but there is a certain limitations on your experiences, your sound perceptions, yeah, the other four khandhas, your form and these things will be limited by where you are reborn. If you're reborn in a very high realm, in a Devaloka, yay, yeah, happy, all these good things happening to me. And yet, again, you have a kind of high limit, a high range of experiences you can have. The khandhas are limited by your rebirth. If it's the animal realm, it is bad. So it is like you are stuck. Yeah, this is why it's called the vinyana, the station of consciousness. You're kind of stuck there for that lifetime, and there's a limit to what you can do. Unless, you know, you practice meditation and you do something like that, then you can kind of raise things even more highly. But you tend to be stuck in a certain, within a certain range of experiences. Because you are stuck with a certain range of experiences, then when you contact the world, you have the six senses, or maybe you have less than the six senses, but when you contact that world, the world will tend to be contacted in that way. So your experience tend to be limited in that way by that world. Yeah, you experience the world in a certain way. Yeah, this is the six sense bases, then the contact which happen according to that. And then the feelings that you have will then be feelings that tend to accord also with that particular realm that you are in. Yeah, you experience mostly happy feelings in the Devaloka and few sad feelings. You feel a lot of negative feelings if you're born as an animal, and then very rarely a very nice monkey gives you some chocolate cake, or you have kangaroo, and then you are very rarely feel this, yay, this is what it's like to be human. May I become human in your next life. That's what the kangaroo thinks. Maybe, yeah, I don't know if he thinks that, but maybe it gets a little bit of inclination in the right way, yeah, because chocolate cake, that is a really good reason for being reborn as a human. Yeah? So, yeah, so your feelings are kind of then limited, yeah, to a certain extent. You feel in that way. But again, it is not entirely, you're not stuck in a sense, because as I mentioned before, contact can be, is understood as being both the, we are kind of the receivers of the external impressions, but the mind also works on the external impressions. Yeah. So if we develop our mind, then the feelings that we feel, the way we experience the world, actually will change within that lifetime. We're not just passive recipients, but how we live our life also decides the feelings. Then, because we feel things, and because feelings are such a fundamental part of what it means to be human, meaning is derived from feeling. Everything we do in life comes from feeling. Yeah, without feeling, nothing has meaning. Yeah? So because this is the, one of the fundamental things that drives meaning in our life, craving must arise as a consequence of feeling. Yeah, because this is what makes things meaningful. Huh? So that's why we are driven to search for those things that are positive, and we are have aversion towards those things that are negative. That's why you are here, yeah? Because dependent origination feels good. Is that right? Does it feel good, yeah? Or at least it gives a sense of meaning, yeah? It gives a greater sense of understanding what Buddhism is about. That gives rise to confidence. Hopefully that gives rise to better practice, yeah? Meaning is a good feeling. Yeah, if things are meaningless, it's a really bad feeling. So you come here, that's why you're a Buddha, that's why you're a monk, that's why you're a nun, that's why we do anything in life. It's because at some level it is positive in a certain way. So we crave. We have desire for all of these kind of things. And to satisfy our cravings, because we want to ensure that our craving is satisfied, we take things up. Uptake or fuel, which is upadana, the next factor of dependent origination. So we take things up, just following the time here. We take things up. What does that mean? It means from the very little things. If you are thirsty, you take up some nice water and then you have a sip of water. Yeah. Or you take up, it's an immediate taking up, a literal meaning of the word taking up. You pick, grasp hold of things because you want to satisfy that sensuality or that desire for something. But it also means picking up in a much broader sense, in the metaphorical sense of picking up ideas, picking up views, picking up a way of living, right? Being a Buddhist, having a job, going to school, all of these large things that we do in our life is a metaphorical way of picking up. All of these picking ups, yeah, if you add them all together, it shapes your life. Your life is shaped by the things that you have picked up, by the way you exist. So then picking up leads to bhava, existence or life. Your life now has taken a certain shape. You become a kind, particular kind of person depending on the things that you have picked up in your life. Yeah? And again, if you want to know what kind of person you are, don't go by what you think you are, because the sense of self gets in the way. Yeah, yeah, I'm a good Buddhist, I practice the five precepts, yeah, I'm bound to have a good rebirth because I do all of these things right. Or you are a monk, yeah, I'm a Buddhist monk, this is the best, yeah, so I'm the best. No, don't think like that, yeah, because that's obviously wrong. Yeah, I'm the best doesn't really, it's not really a very useful way of thinking. So instead, if you want to know where you are, sit down in meditation, allow the superficial things to fade away, and then see where your mind inclines. And that will give you a good idea, a rough idea, of what is your interest, what is your inclination of mind, which is roughly equivalent to your bhava, your existence, who you are as a person. And then again, because this is your existence, this is where you hang out, this is what you're interested in, when you get reborn in a similar way, yeah, depending on that existence and then the craving which propels you forward, projects you on into the future. And then, once you are reborn, as I said before, you are stuffed. Thank you for... I completely forgot about that. I've got this here. Getting too excited about this whole process. Then, when you are reborn, tough luck. Yeah, you have to exist. This is why we're all here. This is why we are suffering now. Because you have been reborn. Have you been reborn? Old age and death happens. All the problems of life happen. And I did go through in quite a bit of detail before what we mean by suffering in Buddhism and the broader context. All of that is included in the suffering here at the end of dependent origination. And then if you don't do anything with this, then you die. You get reborn again. You die. You get reborn again. And this then carries on, potentially without any end in sight, until one day you come across a Buddha. You think, wait a minute, this Buddha, he sounds pretty wise, yeah? Maybe I should hang out with him. Yeah, and this is where we are at. Yeah. Oh, today we're hanging out with the Buddha in a sense by trying to understand his teachings. Now we are finally there. And if you were able to look back into all your past lives, you would see yourself, this person who's kind of struggling, trying to find a way, yeah, getting reborn, dying, reborn, dying. And finally, now we have finally got there to the point where the escape route is in sight for the first time. What is that escape route? And that escape route is the cessation sequence of dependent origination. It's the ending mode of dependent origination, right? When everything comes to an end. And it starts off with the ending of ignorance, yeah? And remember what I was saying before, that ignorance is supported by the five hindrances. So the path to ending ignorance is to eliminate the five hindrances. How do we do that? By entering samadhi. That is the way you do this. You do it gradually through the practice of the Eightfold Path. You cannot do this all at once. You cannot just enter samadhi just like that. Gradually calming things down, gradually eliminating the hindrances, then entering samadhi. And the point of entering samadhi is, when Musinda made many good points before, but the hindrances are gone for a long time. It eliminates the hindrances for a long period. So it gives you that time to have insight as well, yeah, where the mind is pure for a long period of time afterwards. So you enter the samadhi, and then the hindrances are gone. Then you have the opportunity for insight in all the various ways that Vimbasundo explained before, to have that insight. And then when that insight happens, that is where ignorance is abolished. So what does that mean? What it means is that you are no longer seeking for happiness in the future. Yeah, you're no longer looking for happiness somewhere in the future. Why? Because you know that the whole idea of seeking for happiness in the future, this is a process that is endless. That is not where happiness is found. Happiness is found in the present moment by letting go of everything and becoming still here and now. That is where happiness is found. It is not found somewhere in the future. So the whole idea of looking for happiness somewhere else in the future, you understand, it is completely counterproductive. It is counterproductive because it also means that you are craving. And if you are craving is the opposite of being still, you know that that is not the way to find happiness. So suddenly you are looking for happiness in the right place. in the present moment by letting go of any ideas of future. Instead of trying to create something in the future, you're looking for it in the here and now. The will, craving, cannot give you happiness. It's the opposite. It's the letting go of the will that will give you happiness. Yeah. So this is the point. And this is also why the sense of self becomes useless. Because the sense of self is this idea of you being powerful, or you being able to create something. But no, the very act of creation is an act of suffering, yeah, which is problematic. You have to let go of creation itself. So you become still in the present moment. And because you become still in the present moment, you no longer have an interest in creating anything in the future. There are no willed activities. Yeah, the end of willed activities come out as a consequence of seeing things according to reality. The sense of self cannot make this. You're not looking for happiness in the future. You're no longer using willed activities to create happiness, because you know it is the ending of the willed activities that create happiness. Because when they calm down, you enter samadhi, and that is where you find your happiness once you become an arahant, in the stillness of the mind, when you start to understand where these things are. You still have some will left over, but is a functional will. Is a will that makes you function in the world, not a will that creates happiness in the future. You understand this is impossible. And because you no longer have any will, because you're no longer looking to the future for happiness, it means that your consciousness has no longer any inclination. Yeah, I was talking before about the inclination and the bias of consciousness, looking towards something, inclining to the future. You don't have any inclination to the future anymore, because you're no longer looking for happiness in the future. You're no longer looking for rebirth. Yeah, you're no longer looking for any of that, because the future is problematic. So when consciousness has no inclination, there's no craving there, there is nothing to propel you to the future. Craving is a requirement that is needed to propel you onwards, project consciousness into the future. No inclination. Yeah, and because there is no inclination, it means that consciousness is not stationed anywhere. Yeah, it doesn't have any level anymore. It has gone beyond the idea of level, because there's no inclination. Because there's no level, it means that there is no rebirth that corresponds to that consciousness. Because the level of consciousness is where it carries on. There is no corresponding rebirth, because consciousness does not have a level. It doesn't have any inclination. It doesn't have any station anymore. And for that reason, no rebirth. When there's no rebirth, no nama rupa. Yeah, nama rupa, all the personality factors come to an end. Form comes to an end. All the mental aspects come to an end. Because the mental aspects come to an end and form come to an end, consciousness has nowhere to find a footing. There's nowhere for consciousness to go. So consciousness itself must cease. Consciousness and nama rupa, consciousness and personality factor and form, go together. If one ceases, the other one must cease. The two sheaths of reed, one sheath of reed is taken away, it means the other one also must fall. Yeah? And when there's no consciousness and there's no personality factors, what is left? Nothing. This is the end of everything. Yeah, nothing can. There's nothing apart from these things. The five khandhas are all there is. Once that ceases, everything comes to an end. This is the paradox of the Buddhist path. Yeah, everything comes to an end. And if you have a temporary, this was one of those beautiful suttas we just saw before. If you have a temporary experience of everything ending, the moment you come out of that experience, that seems to you as dukkha. Yeah, the moment you start experiencing something, it feels like dukkha, because you have seen the highest kind of happiness that is possible. This is the paradox of things, yeah? Experience itself seems like dukkha to you. And because all of these things cease, it means that there is no sense basis. Because there's no sense basis, there's no contact. And then the whole thing, the whole rest of the path ceases as a consequence. Yeah, when there is nothing, nothing else can really happen. There's an alternative way of thinking about this, and that is to look at it from the seventh factor of dependent origination. Seventh, eighth factor. And that is looking at from the ending of craving. So when avidya ceases, another thing that happens is that craving comes to an end. Because again, you cannot crave for anything because you don't believe that there is any happiness to be found in existence. So all craving comes to an end. When craving comes to an end, there is no need to take anything up to satisfy the craving. Yeah, there's no craving to be satisfied anymore. So you stop picking things up. You stop picking up views. You stop picking up ideas. You stop picking up being a Buddhist. Yeah, you just by default, you are a Dhamma practitioner. You are still part of the Dhamma, but you don't really pick up the idea. Yeah, I'm a Buddhist. You don't hold on to that as something important. So all of these things that we pick up mentally, that we hold on to, that we attach to, all of these things, all attachments are gone. If someone challenges you in whatever way, there's no way, no need for you to defend yourself because you feel really fully satisfied with the way things are. You don't pick anything up, yeah? Everything just has a functional thing in your life. And because you don't pick anything up, your life doesn't really have a shape. It's not as if you are a kind of person living in a particular way. Yeah, your consciousness, again, is not kind of settled in anything. You have given up the whole idea of being a person that exists in a certain way. All you want to do is go back to your little cutie or your room, chill out, chill and relax and just enter into jhana states and be as little as possible. That's what you want to be. You want to be minimum existence, yeah? That's kind of one of the... That's a nice... Minimum existence is kind of the ideal for the arahant, yeah? So not really existence, but as little as possible. And you are looking forward to the day when you're going to cease altogether. And that is the... One of the things, one of the nice little verses, I think, is in the Theragata, where we have Venerable Sariputta. He says, like, being an arahant is like a workman waiting for your wages. Yeah? You're just waiting. Oh, may I come, may I see soon? Yeah? I'm waiting for my wages. And the workman achieving their wages, or the workwoman achieving her wages, is when the arahant passes away. Yeah? Finally, you get your wages. That is the wages. So there is no real existence. So because there is no existence, there is no level for who you are, then again, there's no inclination of the mind. There can be no rebirth. Yeah, the mind is not projecting itself into the future. It is not holding on to these things. There's no station. There is no inclination towards anything. And then everything comes to an end because of that. Because the fuel of upadana, the fuel of craving, has been extinguished. There is no more coming, no more moving towards the future. And that is then the ending of suffering. Yeah, when everything comes to an end. And I just want to remind you that this is very, very difficult to really understand intellectually. In fact, it is impossible to understand this intellectually. And the reason it is because we all come from a distorted perception. And that distorted perception is the sense of self inside of us. The sense of self will tend to see this as something negative, hard to understand. But the moment you take that vested interest in an I, the moment you take that distortion out of the equation, then it is possible to understand why this can be the highest happiness. In the meantime, you have to extrapolate. And the way to extrapolate, as I mentioned before, is to practice the path, practice meditation, and see that when you practice meditation in the right way, when you become more peaceful, when things are starting to end a little bit, already it feels really nice. It feels marvelous. The more things come to an end, the better things feel. And from that, you can start to extrapolate and understand that if everything ceases, it must therefore be the highest happiness. And then you stop being so afraid of it, or seeming it doesn't seem so negative anymore. In fact, it starts to look positive instead. So then, when you have seen all this, avidya has finally come to an end, then what happens? Then, congratulations, you are now an arahant! Yay! So, applause. So, And what happens if you're not an arahant? What happens then? What happens then is this. Yeah, you are on the path, and being on the path means something like this. It was, I didn't really know, sometimes you have to search for these pictures. I searched for just kind of roaming around, I searched for roaming and this came up. So I thought, okay, I'll put that in there. It's a bit random, that's what happens, yeah? So, there you are. So that's what you have to do. You have to kind of carry on with, not with this maybe too much brute force, but you have to carry on with persistence, yeah? And then gradually, you will be moving in the right way. So, may you see dependent origin in this lifetime.
Curtains last.
Need a bit of... Well, good luck might be the wrong word. Anyway, we'll leave that in there. So, there you are. That is the end of the course. If you... Shall we take some... This is towards the very end. Maybe we can... Take some last questions if someone wants to ask. Is that okay, leader of the course? Supreme commander, yeah? Okay, so if anyone would like to ask some final questions, you are very welcome to do so now. Yeah.
Also welcome to leave if you have to or want to.
Yeah. If you want to leave, you can leave as well. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. In the meantime, let me just take a few questions from the that we have still have left over here. So... Briefly, some of these things are not directly related, but I will answer them briefly in any case. Past memories can be painful, leading to despair and inability to do anything. What can I do to move beyond them and make effort to thrive? So, very simply, this is a kind of very practical question, but basically you have to learn to forgive the past. Yeah, very often the pains of the past come from other people, so you have to learn to understand that they have probably their own problems, they are carrying out their inner programs, and they do things not because they want to hurt you, but because often they have no choice. Yeah, they're kind of blocked in a certain way. So you learn to forgive, you learn to have compassion instead, and gradually you move away from this. Easy to say, not so always so easy to do, but you can at least move in that direction. Does letting go mean the middle path, even for nirvana? Yes, letting go is precisely the middle path, yeah? Because remember, what you are letting go of, first of all, is the sensual world, the sensual pleasures and all of these kind of things, yeah? This is one side of the middle path, and the other side you don't have to let go so much, it's easy to let go of, which is the, you know, torturing yourself. So that is exactly the middle path. In fact, as we saw before, the Buddha calls dependent origination, he calls that the Dhamma by the middle. Yeah. So dependent origination, which also is about the cessation of everything, it is about reaching Nibbana itself, that is actually the middle path or the Dhamma in the middle. So letting go is absolutely, precisely what the middle path is like. Please, Venerable Sunni, if you want to add something as we go along, you're very welcome. Otherwise, I will just fire away here. Pantas, jhanas is a form of bhava, not the goal of nibbana. One can also be stuck to the jhanas, which is one of the 10 fetters. What is your view on this? You can be stuck on anything in Buddhism. You can be stuck on kindness, you can be stuck on sila, you can be stuck on generosity, you can be stuck on metta, you can be stuck anywhere on the path, yeah, if you're not wise. So our job is to overcome anytime when you are stuck, you should be moving forward. So the question is, of course you can be stuck. So the question is then that people sometimes think that means you should not practice jhana because you can be stuck on them. But you can really be stuck anywhere. So that would mean you should not practice any of these things, but because all of these things can make you stuck. Yeah? So that is the wrong answer. The answer is that we need to overcome that stuckness. That is the right way to think. Yeah. So if you are stuck anywhere, it means that you learn to deal with that stuckness. Can you be stuck on jhanas? No, you can be stuck afterwards, after you come out. Yeah, you think too much about it. You crave to get there again. That craving to get there again, that can make you stick. Why? Because craving is actually the opposite of jhana. It gets in the way. So you learn to deal with that in the right way. You learn to be content with what you have. And you learn not to desire these things. Yeah? Gradually you overcome it. That is the right way of dealing with it. Not doing the jhana. So.
Yeah, in a sense, the 10 fetters, some of these fetters is like attachment to the jhanas. But you have those regardless of whether you practice the jhanas or not, in a sense. Because the jhanas are like a very subtle type of existence, and if you're not enlightened, you are sort of attached to it, even though you don't really know yet. You haven't really experienced the jhanas yet, but to that sort of existence, you're still attached. So,
in a deeper
sense. Yeah. So whether you practice them or not, the fetter is there regardless. So they definitely practice them, because in the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha said, whoever is attached to the jhanas can only expect to become a stream enterer, once return and non-return or arahant. So sounds like a good thing to be attached to, in a sense.
Yeah. Okay, next one. Question. I understand this is a gradual path, yet also feel a lot of urgency. How do you balance patience and urgency here? So much gratitude to you, Ajahn Brahmali, and Venerable Srinivas. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's very nice. So how do you balance these things? Well, urgency, if you are really urgent, then you understand the urgency of patience. Yeah? That's what you understand. I've got to be patient now. Yeah, I can't wait. Now is the time to be patient. So this is the idea, is that patience actually is the fast path. Yeah? The fast path is not running around like a madman or a madwoman. That actually is, so you take more time to just be content. You understand the importance of contentment, of being with things as they actually are. So that is the right way to think about it. The urgency is actually the urgency to be patient. Ajahn Brahm talks about the second jhana being in the center of the first jhana. Do you need to see, set an adhitana before going into the first jhana, that you will proceed into the second jhana? I don't know if adhitana is the right word, because adhitana can sometimes, these things, if you do it in the wrong way, adhitana, you know, is like a determination sometimes. Determination is too close to willpower and to willing something here. What usually determines which jhana you go into is the development of the mind beforehand. How developed your mind is, the kind of the momentum of the peace, if you like, that you have. So if you are kind of, if you have a very strong, powerful nimitta, and you're moving kind of very strongly towards peace, yeah, the mind, not you, but the mind is doing that, then you will have a deeper jhana as a consequence. Not really so much because of determination, but because of the power of the mind prior to entry. And then you go into, you know, deeply into these things. They're going one through the other one and kind of moving through the jhanas very rapidly. And then you will end up at a certain point, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, depending on that power, the degree of peace and degree of momentum of the mind as you move in. Not because you are determining it, not because you are desiring it, but because of all these factors coming together at that point. Question. Dying during jhana will lead one to one of the higher realms, because there is still a sense of self. But during deep samadhi jhana, when sitting, we experience no self. Please correct me. Yes, that is correct. You don't have an experience of self because the mind is completely still. You cannot have an experience of self when the mind is completely still. That's why you don't experience it. Yeah, it's basically completely gone. There's complete peace at that point. But it is still underlying it, and that's why it re-arises afterwards. And the same way that when you have during a jhana goes to the higher realm, is not because there is a sense of self at that point, but because there is the underlying sense of self is also there when you get reborn in the jhana realm. The same principle applies. Yeah? Reborn in the jhana realm is completely parallel, the same thing as actually being in a jhana in this life. The only difference is it lasts longer. Longer, that's the difference. Okay. comment, thumb down for not recognizing the difference between kamma and vipaka. People should know the difference. It's crucial. Yes, indeed. So kamma is the actions that you do and vipaka are the results. Yeah. So you act and then the results you get from that actions is vipaka. Yeah. So you live badly and then the results come as a consequence. Yeah. Both in this life and also across from the future life. From this life to the future life. Another comment. Much gratitude to Ajahn Vamali and Venerable Sunyo for the profound talks on dependent origination. Big thank you to the BSWA and the AV team for live streaming. So many people around the world can join in real time. The energy is great. Yay! Well done.
Sorry. Jake, you did an excellent job.
One last comment. And then I will comment afterwards. Comment, much gratitude to Ramal and Venerable Sunyo, and thank you to Lehar Go, or Go Lehar, depending on where in the world you are, and the BSWA team.
All right.
So, that we are now coming to the very end. And before I pass over to Lehar and anyone else who wants to say anything, I would like just to say my 5 cents first. Is that okay? Can I start out? And I would just like to, first of all, I would like to thank my fellow presenter, Venerable Sunyo, because when I started out and I asked him whether he wanted to be part of this, and it wasn't even my suggestion or rhythm, it actually came from the lay people, which is really nice, because when you come from the lay people, you know that you are wanted as a presenter. So it's wonderful that happened. So I said this to him, and I thought he'd probably say no, that's what I thought. But actually he didn't. And I thought that is a sign of courage, is a sign of maturity, and I think he has really proved his mettle through this course, that he really knows the sutta as well, he has plenty of insight into and personal practice and to back it up and all of these kind of things. So I want to thank him for taking part and for sharing the burden. It's very hard to do these things all on your own, and I think it's very brave when you only, still, 5 reins is not that senior as a monastic, yeah? It's very brave and very praiseworthy that he came on board with this. A big, big thank you to Venerable Sunyo. Then I would like to thank all the bhikkhunis. Thank you for taking part. Thank you for doing your share, guided and meditation. It's so nice to have so many monastics here, and it's marvelous to have the nuns also more visible here at Dhammaloka and taking part in the teaching burden. I hope you will be able to take even more part in the future. Maybe one day we will have one or two of you sitting up here and helping out with the actual teaching. I know you very well, and you are incredibly knowledgeable, and you know more, sometimes you know more than probably the majority amongst them, doesn't know more than I do, and it's, you know, you're such a potential resource for the Buddha Society, and I really hope that resource will come out even better in the future. So a big sadhu for the nuns for their work and being
here. Sadhu, sadhu.
Then, Venerable Metaji, thank you for coming as well. It's very nice to have another monk being present. Maybe more monks will come in the future. Maybe we'll see what happens. But it's very nice to have Venerable Metaji around as well to help us out. And then I would like to also thank our marvelous Lehar, who actually was the one who suggested this course originally. So it is her fault that you are all here. Yeah, she is the one who decided this. And she, as always, a very hardworking and a very kind of, so she is basically kind of the organizer behind all of this. So whenever you see things on the website, whenever you see things being organized, getting everyone together and getting this thing done, it is Lehar who is behind all of this. So what a wonderful thing that is. And then we have, of course, the AV team led by our very own Jake Mitra, who is a very long-standing member of the Buddhist Society. And he and his wife, Cecilia, they are almost like Mr. and Mrs. Buddhism. Yeah? They live and breathe Buddhism pretty much, and they've been very good supporters. And then the rest of the AV team also. So big hand for them as well.
And then I would like, and I've probably forgotten some people who have also, I always forget somebody. Yeah, people who are sitting outside. Thank you everyone for all you have done. And thank you for all the participants. This is what really makes it nice when we all come together and we do these things. We get a beautiful atmosphere, yeah, positive vibe in here, and all coming together doing this in a good way. So let us give ourselves, everyone, a good applause towards the end. Big triple sadhu because we're all Buddhists. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, now I will pass over to Lehar. You want to say something, Lehar?
You said everything, Ajahn. So you mentioned about thanking the people who sit outside. Actually, I have a few because I have a small army of people. I don't do everything on my own. Chun Seng is the one who did the booking system and receiving all the bookings. Pat and Wee Cheng, they help out with the registration. So yeah, so it's efforts of everyone to be able to get this. And we've got a lot of questions from people asking, are we doing the next class? What is the next class? There are topics that have been suggested as well. So the only thing I can say is the future is uncertain. Because first, the teachers have to be there. I did exchange some emails with Ajahn Brahmali on a potential lease, of course, and he thought I'm overdoing it. So it's like, slow down, Leha, slow down. So I have to like slowly convince him. And as much as people say that, the world is hit by COVID, it's really bad, you know. But I think it's also this time that we don't see the monks traveling as much as they do, and that's why I thought, better seize the day and ask the monks to teach. And I really do enjoy the first two series. And it was so hard at the time when I finished the first series, which was the early Buddhism, and we kept pestering Bhante Sujato and Ajahn Brahmali, and I think we waited for years. And then this time I'm like, not going to wait for years. So we'll see. I don't know when we're going to plan the next one because it all depends on the monks, the teachers' availability as well. But yeah, for sure. And the other thing Ajahn Brahmali told me was that cannot do this too often. Otherwise, it's not special anymore. So we got to be careful on the frequency as well. Yeah, but otherwise, we don't know yet. Definitely, we'll plan something, hopefully, in the near future. And then we'll keep everyone posted. But I'm very glad that you guys are very collaborative and very supportive. You know, like when we have breakout sessions, you see that everyone is kind of like contributes and everybody has a fair share of airtime. Yeah. So I hope you guys have enjoyed the class, and thanks Ajahn Brahmali and Venerable Sunil for accepting my invitation. So that was really great. Otherwise we won't be here today. And to all of us, don't come here next Saturday, no more class. All right, thank you everyone.
Okay, so may I suggest that we just finish off by paying respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.